I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC FM 90.9. I'm Alexandra Cox, a member of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective. Today's show focuses on the issue of reproductive rights in the criminal justice system. We're going to be hearing a story on reproductive rights that is produced by Making Contact, a project of National Prison Radio. Making Contact produces media that analyzes critical social and environmental issues and showcases grassroots solutions in order to inform and inspire audiences to action. Their work heightens public consciousness, broadens debate on critical social issues, and encourages civic participation by giving voice to diverse perspectives and opinions underrepresented in the mass media. Their goal is to produce media that informs, inspires, and moves people to action. The show we will be airing is about the issue of reproductive health behind bars. Within our listening area, there is one facility housing young women, Columbia Girls Secure Center, operated by the Office of Children and Family Services. It is located in Claverack and is a secure juvenile facility for young women charged as adults. A number of young women in New York's juvenile justice system are pregnant and parenting, and this story has relevance for them. I wanted to begin today with some stories from the news about criminal justice policy-related issues. These last few weeks have seen a great deal of news in the world of criminal justice reform, from substantial attention being focused on Rikers Island as it faces scrutiny for its practices of solitary confinement, to St. Louis, Missouri, where we have seen yet another police shooting. In Wayne County, Pennsylvania last week, a 10-year-old boy was charged as an adult after allegedly murdering an elderly woman under the care of his grandfather. Tristan Carrilla, a fifth grader who celebrated his 10th birthday in July, confessed to beating a 90-year-old woman called Helen Novak with his fists and choking her with a cane after she yelled at him to leave her room. Novak died shortly after the assault. On Monday, Carrilla was arraigned on charges of criminal homicide and aggravated assault. He's currently being held without bail in a segregated area of Wayne County Correctional Facility, away from other inmates. Carrilla faces a minimum sentence of 25 years in prison. This story of a young boy, 10 years old, charged as an adult, highlights the persistence of our punitive laws and practices aimed at young people, despite recent Supreme Court cases limiting the ability of states to use the death penalty and life without imprisonment for juveniles. In Florida, a white man named Michael Dunn was sentenced to life in prison after killing black teenager Jordan Davis. He shot Jordan Davis 10 times after he complained about Davis's loud music coming from his car. This sentence was seen as a victory for many who saw this case as yet another instance of white supremacy and racism aimed at a young teenager of color. However, I wonder whether we should ask more questions about the ways that we celebrate this kind of justice for some, but decry them for others. May we begin to look at ways to limit the high level of punitiveness and the lengthy sentences in this country, while also ensuring that crimes of vigilantism, driven by white supremacy, like those done by George Zimmerman and Michael Dunn, are condemned? In other recent news, ProPublica, a news research organization, just released an interesting new analysis of police shootings. They analyzed data from 2010 to 2012 from the FBI Supplementary Homicide Report, which includes reporting from a number of major police departments across the country, not including the NYPD, unfortunately. In their analysis, they found that young black males were 21 times more likely to be shot dead by police than their white counterparts. Interestingly, these shootings were not just limited to white officers. Black officers were just as likely to engage in these shootings, raising serious questions about calls for the diversification of police forces as a police reform strategy. That's all the news I have for today. You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on 90.9 WGXC. I'm Alexandra Cox, and I'm a part of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective. Next, we're going to be hearing a story from Making Contact, a national radio project report on reproductive justice in prisons.
This week on Making Contact.
We have these stories of people having their ovaries and their uteruses removed. Either they were not informed or they were misled.
Pregnant women in America's prisons are being shackled to their beds. Others are being sterilized, some say against their will. Correctional institutions claim the policies are for safety's sake and that consent is always obtained, but others see a larger pattern at work.
There's a history of locking up women of color through the years in which they might be able to reproduce and ignoring their reproductive health needs. I would tie that back to the idea that women of color should not be allowed to reproduce.
On this edition, from birth control to giving birth, thousands of incarcerated people are struggling to maintain control over their own reproductive health. I'm Jen Cheehan, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Imagine you're in prison. You're wearing a jumpsuit that's too big for you, or maybe it's too small. Heavy chains around your ankles and wrists make it difficult to walk without tripping. Another metal chain is tied around your waist, and it's attached to the person in front of you and also to the person behind. Now, imagine that you're 7 months pregnant. Thousands of incarcerated women around the United States have had the experience of being shackled throughout their pregnancy. And as producer Lisa Bartfai found out, there's a growing movement to ban the practice.
That's very disturbing and uncomfortable to be in a hospital like that and cuffed up and not feeling like human and being able to bond with your baby and stuff like that.
Back in May 1993, Samantha Rogers was locked up at the Central California Women's Facility, CCWF, where she also gave birth to her son.
Well, at the time I went in labor, we went to the infirmary at CCWF, and the nurses didn't even like really want to deliver my baby because they kept saying they wasn't qualified to do it. And he came out, and my afterbirth didn't come out until the ride to the hospital. And we both came out the building naked. They put a sheet over me, and my son had a blanket, and that's how we went to Merced Hospital. And as soon as I got there, they like immediately put a gown on me, and they handcuffed my ankle to the bed.
Lying there, handcuffed to the bed, Samantha says someone did speak up for her.
The nurse noticed that he was handcuffed my ankle to the bed, and she was like, "Is that necessary for you to put that handcuff on her ankle right now?" she made a big scene about it and stuff like that, and she just walked off. And but she was there, you know, talking to me and, you know, trying to keep me calm from what happened and stuff like that.
Back in 2003, Carolyn Selfrin found herself on the other side of that scene.
What got me interested in this population in the first place was an experience in 2003 when I was a resident in training in obstetrics and gynecology in Pennsylvania, and I delivered the baby of a woman who was shackled to the bed. And it was an extremely traumatic experience for me as a doctor, and also for the patient.
Since then, Carolyn has seen many women restrained.
That can include handcuffs, it can include belly chains, it can include chains around the ankles.
These restraints can be a real danger. Having hands and feet tied up makes it very difficult to walk, and falling is an ever-present threat. For pregnant women, the consequences of a fall can be catastrophic.
If there is any sign of fetal distress, as medical practitioners, we need to respond rapidly, within seconds. And if a woman is shackled, if she's restrained in any way, then that really limits our ability to intervene. And in those moments, we do not have time to be negotiating with a guard, with a correctional officer, to say, hey, would you mind just unlocking those handcuffs, those restraints? That's just not what we should be spending our time doing. And if we lose time in acting in these emergency situations, then that can cause some serious harm.
Stories from medical professionals like Carolyn are common. But getting statistics on exactly how many pregnant women there are in prison can be difficult.
Not the county jails or the juvenile facilities actually keep a count of who's pregnant in their custody. Nationally, the estimate is it's around 10% of incarcerated women are pregnant.
That's Karen Shane. She's the former policy director at Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, an advocacy group based in San Francisco.
There are approximately somewhere between 10 and 15,000 women in prison, jail, and juvenile facilities at any time in California, which is extraordinarily high. And of those, if you figure that it's about 10%, we believe that there's somewhere up to about 1,500 women on any particular day who is pregnant and incarcerated in our state.
California isn't the only state where pregnant women in prison are shackled. For some, it's been an experience that has moved them to action.
Well, I believe that the experience that I had being handcuffed and shackled in transit from the jail to the prison, and then the experience I had being handcuffed and shackled while giving birth, sparked my anger.
Most states still don't have special protections for pregnant prisoners. They're restrained and handcuffed just like any other inmate. Back in 1994, Tina Reynolds gave birth to her son in Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in New York.
I was able to put aside the reason why I was in prison. You know, it could happen to me. I was in prison. I committed the crime. Okay. But my son had nothing to do with it. He was not a co-conspirator to my crime. So why was I being treated like that? And why was the possibility, if there were to be, and God forbid, any harm that would come to me while I was in labor or birth, there would certainly be harm that would come and befall on him. And so why would that have to happen?
Tina walked out of prison together with her son 9 months later. On the outside, she got together with other formerly incarcerated women. Out of their meetings grew a new organization called Women on the Rise Telling Her Story, or WORTH.
You know, our society thinks that if you do the crime, then you do the time, and whatever comes with that time, you should be able to deal with it. We criminalize people. We punish people. We are a punishing society. And so we really don't look at it from a perspective of treating people humanely. And unfortunately, that's the way it's looked at. But in this particular case, we're not considering the harm that can be done both psychologically, mentally, emotionally, and physically.
WORTH's mission was to change the way people think about incarcerated women. In 2009, the group began campaigning for a law to ban shackling in New York.
You shame on
Worth held speak outs and rallies to push the issue. The most powerful tool they had to create public awareness was a simple one, stories.
What we did as an organization, we began interviewing women who'd actually had the experience of being shackled. And we strengthened their stories by giving them the support that they needed to share their stories with the media and various media outlets. And so as the public became more aware of this particular practice that was going on, and this was huge, and we didn't think that a lot of people considered the fact that women went to prison pregnant.
By telling their stories, Tina says the women in Worth found support and success. That year, New York became the seventh state to limit the use of handcuffs and chains during pregnancy and birth. Worth now supports groups in other states like Georgia, Massachusetts, and Virginia who are pushing for protections for pregnant women in prison. But it isn't always easy. Moves to end shackling have been met with stiff resistance, often from staff working inside prisons and jails. Just listen to this General Assembly in Virginia in October 2012.
You've heard several testimony here today, some of it very inflammatory. It's unfortunate that some of the information that was provided to you simply isn't true. I know that the Virginia Association of Regional Jail Superintendents, I'm one of 21 of those. I just heard took a no position on it. I'm opposed to the bill in the sense that it's taking away or mandating law, Mr. Chairman, where it should be policy and procedure.
Despite opposition like this, a growing number of states have passed legislation to limit the use of restraints during pregnancy. Thanks in part to doctors like Carolyn Sulfrin, a fellow of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
The risk that a woman who's having painful contractions is going to run off or be a threat to public safety is pretty minimal. Some of these women also choose to have epidurals during labor, and in that case, their legs are numb and they're not able to run off. So from a common sense perspective, it doesn't make much sense. And from a medical perspective, it is dangerous and interferes with our ability to provide comprehensive care and emergency care.
We'll hear more about the campaign to stop shackling after the break. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of the program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Coming up.
It's very clear that the shackling and the sterilization are very connected and really come out of a sense of our communities not mattering enough to protect.
But first, Making Contact's Lisa Bartfy finds out how formerly incarcerated people are organizing to stop the shackling of pregnant women in prison.
California passed a bill banning shackling during labor back in 2004. Karen Shane, formerly of Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, takes up the story.
Well, there's been an international move to stop the shackling of pregnant women during labor and delivery. We worked with pregnant women throughout that time and began the process of trying to end shackling with a bill in 2004 that stopped the shackling of pregnant women during labor, delivery, and recovery.
But campaigners say they began to realize that this law didn't go far enough.
But very soon after that, we began to get letters from pregnant women. And the one that really struck us was a woman named Pauline, who was in Contra Costa County Jail here, right here in the Bay Area, who wrote us a letter and said that she found out she was pregnant while she was in jail. And during that time, she went through almost her entire pregnancy. She had to go out to court. She had to go to the hospital. She had to go to doctor's appointments. And every time she was shackled around her belly, she was handcuffed. And then she also had shackles around her ankles. And then her handcuffs were attached to a person in front of her. And she said, "Isn't that illegal?"
It turned out it was legal. The law in California only protected women in the last 48 hours of their pregnancy. Karen says campaigners felt they needed to come up with a better plan. And in the winter of 2012, Governor Jerry Brown signed Assembly Bill 2530 into law.
I think the main thing that it changes is that women who are incarcerated, whether they're juveniles or whether they're so-called adult women, if they're pregnant, there is now a law on the books that they are supposed to be treated humanely.
Remember the doctor we heard from earlier, Carolyn Sulfrin? How she says that medical staff don't have time to wait for correctional officers to remove restraints in an emergency. Well, Karen says that California's 2012 law addresses just that. Under the new law, any medical personnel that is caring for a pregnant woman can order handcuffs and chains to be removed at once.
We were able to win this particular battle, but it's only one battle. And I think that that's true across the country, is that you do the best you can, and then you keep at it. And for us, it was really about community organizing, getting more and more people to sign petitions and call the governor and write letters and talk to each other. And we won. You know, we won, but people are still in prison. We have a long, long way to go.
That was Karen Shane, former policy director for Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. That report was brought to us by Lisa Bartfai. Shackling is just one of the reproductive health issues people inside U.S. prisons face. For years, activists have tried to draw attention to the many challenges to getting proper reproductive health care in prison.
Prisons destroy women's reproductive capabilities, both literally with invasive medical procedures or negligent health care or life-threatening health care, and also by looking at who gets sentenced to prison and for how long.
That's Victoria Law.
I'm a writer, a photographer, and a mother. I write about women in prison and resistance and organizing.
When she was growing up, Victoria saw a lot of her friends going to prison, and that started her lifelong commitment to prison issues. She was involved in the successful anti-shackling campaign in New York we heard about earlier. She says time and again she's seen prisons damage women's reproductive health.
Prisons often will interfere with a woman's ability to reproduce, you know, whether through extreme medical neglect or through medically invasive procedures like hysterectomies and other surgeries that destroy her ability to reproduce, but aren't necessarily the only option to treat whatever it is.
Sterilizing prisoners without their consent for the purpose of birth control is illegal. But a few years ago, activists in California began to hear stories from people inside prison that concerned them.
Around 2005, 2006, what people inside and people in our office noticed is that several people were getting approached by doctors inside the prison, really encouraging them to undergo sterilization, so removal of their ovaries, removal of their uterus.
That's Courtney Hooks, Campaign and Communications Director for Justice Now, a California group that works with prisoners to document human rights abuses.
So we have these stories of people having their ovaries and their uteruses removed, ostensibly for medically necessary purposes, but really upon further review, seeing that either they were not informed about it or that they were misled and that the surgery was performed as an overly aggressive response to whatever physical ailment they did have. So someone having fibroids, for instance, which oftentimes are benign and don't require such invasive remedies.
Okay, I'm just going to talk about our experience in prison. You was there with me, remember?
Do you remember? Of course you do.
Mommy remembers because it was horrible.
Kimberly was one of those who told her story to Justice Now in a video testimony. She was 5 months pregnant when she was sent to Valley State Prison for Women for shoplifting in 2009.
I was really scared to be in prison and be pregnant because I knew that the medical department, even just for the regular population, it just really was kind of horrible. You couldn't get the medical services that you needed. So I was really fearful for my unborn baby's safety and health being pregnant in prison. there were a lot of the women in the prison were saying how there was this one doctor in the prison that was doing all these surgeries and taking a lot of the women's uterus. And I thought that was the most bizarre thing that anyone could say.
One of the most important things that I think that people inside prison have been doing is informing each other about their experiences and really giving people a heads up that this has been going on, and that when you go into the doctor's office, beware.
I was told by this same doctor that I had two fibroid tumors that were the size of grapefruits, and wow, you know, I couldn't believe it when he said that I was going to need to have the full hysterectomy. He told me that they needed to be removed because they were so huge that if they burst, I could bleed internally. So I had asked if I could get a second opinion, or if I could talk to someone else, or if I could really wait until I got released from the prison and went to a doctor outside of prison. And that way I would have my second opinion, and then I can explore other options other than a full hysterectomy. And he insisted and insisted that I do this procedure now. And I felt really, really uncomfortable. He was really, really putting the pressure down really heavy on me to sign a form authorizing me to have this surgery within a week. And I told him that there was no way that I would have this surgery within a week without talking to someone, at least talking to my family. And he almost would not let me leave his office unless I agreed to have this surgery within a week.
Eventually, Kimberly says she was able to leave the doctor's office and she didn't have the operation. But when she got out of prison, she went to get a second opinion, and she got a surprising answer.
I went to the doctor and I asked, you know, I told him, you know, that in prison, I was told that I had these two fibroid tumors and a hysterectomy was necessary. So when the doctor did ran tests on me, they didn't see any tumors. They thought that was just really weird that this doctor saw two the size of grapefruits, but doctors on the outside didn't see any tumors.
That wasn't the only questionable medical experience Kimberly had in prison. When it came time to have her baby, Kimberly was taken to a local state hospital for a cesarean section.
And right before they were going to do, I was had already received the epidural. I already was under the anesthesia. And moments before the surgery was to start, the doctor told me, he said, so this is a tubal ligation. I panicked.
Kimberly was on the operating table, had anesthesia put into her, so she was starting to fade. And the doctor asked her at that moment about getting a tubal ligation.
So I panicked and I'm like, no, this is not a tubal ligation. We're not doing a tubal ligation here. So I think he was under the impression that, you know, since I was having the C-section, that he could just go ahead and just tie my tubes and do a tubal ligation. But I had never consented to that.
Kimberly's story is absolutely horrifying, and anyone that hears it should be horrified. There should be no feelings of justification. She doesn't know whether or not she actually did have the tubal ligation because she can't access her medical records. And just to not know what actually happened to you. But as you'll hear on her story, she's talking about not being fully conscious. So having anesthesia put into her body, her going under, being sedated, and the doctor handing her a form.
So what he did was he brought in a form and he had me sign it saying that I did not wish to have the tubal ligation. And I was very uncomfortable because I was under anesthesia and I didn't really know if I was signing it right. I don't even think I had enough time to read it because it was a long form and the surgery was about to start. You know, all the doctors were around, you know, waiting to do the surgery. And here I am, you know, reading legal forms, which I felt like I probably should have done that at a more appropriate time, not while I'm under anesthesia and Velcroed down to the table, getting ready to have a C-section, just major surgery. So I was really nervous about that. I don't really think I read it, but I tried to read it as best as I could, because I really didn't want, you know, I wasn't really in the right state of mind to make a decision like that, whether I wanted to have my tubes taut or not, you know. But I signed somewhere, and that was that. That was that. I signed the paper. And I really don't know if I signed to have the tubal ligation or to not have the tubal ligation. I never received a copy of the paper. I've tried to receive copies of it, but I wasn't able to.
It's not my story, and it's also, in a way, as a Black woman, like, very much in my veins, that history of not being valued and having your body be considered fair game for other people who have been given more power and given more value in society to do with in whatever way they want. So I'm a Black woman. My family was enslaved in this country. You know, our baby making was considered money making for certain people, slaveholders. And then after that, having grown up on government assistance, my mom's baby making was seen as something that should not be happening. I was seen as someone who should not exist, or if I do exist, not be given full access to certain resources to ensure that I can live a good life. So those are just a couple of sort of examples of ways that I think that this particular story, Kimberly's story, as well as other stories, really resonate and reverberate through my body and I'm sure many other people's.
Justice Now is campaigning for an investigation into stories like Kimberly's.
I think her story is very important for us to listen to, and why the investigation needs to be held, because there were 180 at least between 2006 and 2010 of these surgeries that happened, specifically while people were giving birth or shortly after. And just knowing that that was Kimberly's experience really does, I think, need to send a red flag about the context that these all happened within.
Courtney Hooks says she wants to see stricter laws in place to make sure that any medical procedures done in prison are carried out with full informed consent. But ultimately, she says they need to go further.
Well, I think that we really have to look at the shackling and the sterilization in the larger context of why are people inside those jails and prisons, and how can we start to remove people from that setting, put people back home, put people back in their communities, in our communities, and really make sure that people have what they need to stay out and to not end up there in the first place. Because these things keep happening, these abuses keep happening, and we can and we should definitely put our efforts towards attempting to stop them while people are inside. But for the longer term, really making sure that people don't end up in a place where abuses are so likely and, I think, inevitable to occur.
Groups like Justice Now believe that sharing these women's stories and experiences is a powerful first step toward ensuring that all people in prison receive proper health care. As was seen in the anti-shackling campaigns, personal testimonies can help shape the public's view of these hidden issues.
Introducing Samantha. Samantha.
At an event in 2012 to celebrate the passage of the anti-shackling law in California, Samantha Rogers reflected on the power of sharing her own story.
Hello, everybody. Like they said, my name is Samantha Rogers, and I was one of the women inside that was shackled. I'm very honored that I was chosen to speak, and I'm very honored to be in a room with people that fought for that, because that is humiliating. Change is here. It's here. The more we get involved in what's going on in the community, in the world, around statewide, the more changes is coming to be, because more everybody is being aware of what really happens behind closed doors. Thank you for letting me share.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Eric Galatis from Denver, Colorado, got in touch to tell us why he values Making Contact.
I listen to Making Contact on KGNU, and it's the best news source that I get every week. I hear voices on that show that I can't hear anywhere else on the radio dial.
We want to hear from you, too. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Jen Chien. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
That was a show produced by Making Contact, a project of the National Radio Project, and it was a show on reproductive justice. You're listening to 90.9 FM WGXC, the Prison Voices Project. Next, we'll hear The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill by Lauryn Hill.
So fast today, the past it seems so far away, and life squeezes so tight that I can't breathe. And every time I've tried to be what someone else thought of me, so caught up I was unable to achieve. But deep in my heart, many cry for help, searching outside of themselves. Now I know that his strength is within me, and deep in my heart, the answer, it wasn't me. My own destiny. And
You're listening to WGXC FM 90.9, the Prison Voices Project. I'm Dr. Alexandra Cox, and I'm a professor at SUNY New Paltz. I'm also a member of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective. Next, we're going to be listening to a speech by Lynn Paltrow, who runs the organization National Advocates for Pregnant Women. I first met Lynn back in around 1999 when I was interning for the American Civil Liberties Union Drug Policy Litigation Project. I worked on a case then involving pregnant women who were drug tested in order to receive prenatal care in South Carolina. That case eventually went to the Supreme Court. While I was working on that case, we collaborated with Lynn on an amicus brief, and I learned everything I know about reproductive justice from her. In the following excerpt from a speech that she gave at the Drug Policy Alliance National Conference in 2011, Lynn talks about the constraints on reproductive rights for women who use drugs while they're pregnant.
Paltrow works in one of the toughest areas of drug policy reform, pregnant women and drug use. Lynn knows what a challenge is, and she has repeatedly shown that she knows how to overcome and how to move forward, protecting the rights and the lives of women. Lynn Paltrow.
Thank you. So the mandate for those of us speaking here was to talk about the challenges of movement building with certain groups. And I start by showing our logo, and you can see I have a challenge. People read my name tag, and they're like, we're glad you're here, but we don't really get it. My organization is probably the only reproductive rights group that works to bridge the reproductive rights and justice movement with the drug policy reform movement. And one of the biggest challenges, and it goes both ways, but I'll start this way, is how to explain to people who are committed to preserving the right to choose abortion, who care about reproductive rights, that they also have to care about drug policy reform. Now, I should explain that the plenary speakers got an email from Ethan not too long ago that explained what he wanted, including a high level of intellectual content. So I'm hoping the next two slides satisfy that. We've been working on looking at the arrest of every pregnant woman between 1973 and 2005, in which that arrest, a necessary factor, included that she was pregnant. And though the cases we've found and identified by no means only involve women who've used illegal drugs, many of them have. And if you'll see by this high intellectual content slide, and you are among the first audience anywhere to see it, that tracks the arrests in which a pregnancy is a necessary element of the crime. And you'll notice that the greatest number of arrests occur between 1989 and 1991, which coincides with the hyperventilating media scare about pregnant women and prenatal exposure to drugs for newborns. So I explain to the groups that I speak to when I'm speaking to reproductive rights, birthing rights organizations, that they have to understand how this works. So you get arrests of pregnant women who use drugs. But the interesting thing is the vast majority are not arrested for a drug crime. They're arrested for child endangerment. So what's going on? It works like this. In South Carolina, the only state we've lost in, Cornelia Whitner gives birth to a healthy child, but the baby tests positive for cocaine. She's charged with child endangerment. She pleads guilty, hoping to get treatment. The judge says, no, I think I'll send you to jail for 10 years. And the state Supreme Court, the only one in the country to uphold these kinds of actions thus far, says we have interpreted our child endangerment statute, risk of harm, to apply to viable fetuses. And any woman who uses an illegal drug or engages in any other behavior that might endanger the fetus can go to jail. Well, very shortly after that decision, they started arresting women in South Carolina who used marijuana. And then women who used alcohol. And then they arrested Regina McKnight, a woman who suffered a stillbirth. They blamed it on her cocaine use, but let me just tell you, cocaine is not associated with pregnancy losses. If you live in a state where it's hard to get an abortion, don't use cocaine. It's not going to help you out. So what she was really, she was convicted of depraved heart homicide. Any pregnant woman who unintentionally heightens the risk of a stillbirth can go to jail as a murderer. With the help of the DPA and the DKT Liberty Project, we were able eventually to get the unanimous South Carolina Supreme Court to say her lawyer failed to adequately represent her because the actual science does not find even an association, much less a causal relation. But that law, that a pregnant woman who suffers a stillbirth can be charged with murder, is still on the books, having started with a case around drugs. Now, if you have an unintentional stillbirth and you can be charged with murder in South Carolina, what do you think is going to happen if Roe is overturned and you intentionally end your pregnancy? Shortly after that, a woman named Jessica Clyburn was pregnant. She got very depressed, and so depressed that when she was 8 months pregnant, she jumped out of a window. She landed on an awning and survived. She lost the pregnancy. She was severely injured. What did the state of South Carolina do? They arrested her for homicide by child abuse. The papers only reported the loss of her fetus and not the harm she suffered, and in order not to face a possible murder charge, she pled guilty to manslaughter. And then I got an email from a South Carolina midwife who said, you know, I took a woman in to be counseled. She had she was breech, and the doctor said, you know, you can have any birth you want, but if something goes wrong in South Carolina, you could be prosecuted for a crime. So that's how it works. In Alabama, they pass a law, a chemical endangering law, to punish parents who take children to a meth lab. Sounds reasonable. Who's been arrested? 50 pregnant women who have given birth, gone through pregnancy and given birth and tested positive for an illegal drug, because in Alabama, apparently, a pregnant woman's womb is no different from a meth lab. But it also works the other way. Mississippi is going to vote next week on Proposition 26 to declare fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses persons under the law. Does it have anything to do with any of you here? You bet it does, because the first way that that's going to be applied, I can assure you, is to pregnant drug-using women. We know that because when Texas passed a prenatal protection act in response to violence against pregnant women, what did they do? They first applied it to pregnant drug-using women and said that doctors had to turn in their patients. We can't build a movement if we say it's okay for some people to use drugs but not others. Gil Kerlikowske defended our drug policies, opposed, wrote an article about the Global Commission, and said we still have to have criminalization. Why? Because drug use is not a victimless crime. How does he know it? He visited newborns in a prenatal care clinic who had been prenatally exposed to prescription drugs. I am proud that it is no longer a discussion of collateral damage at conferences like these, but a challenge is also having the time and the space to talk about child welfare. Child welfare laws in this country and the system is a major vector for the drug war. L. Wallace Pate, if you're here, has been challenging it in L.A. We have a situation where we have federal dollars being spent to teach that children of parents who use drugs are 2 to 3 times more likely to be abused. That's not only junk science, it's defamation. We need to be working with the drug policy, with the child welfare advocates. We need more than one group. Why do we have this problem? Why do we focus on illegal drugs as the greatest risk to children? Because it keeps the focus on individuals. We don't look at societal factors. Only 3 to 5% of pregnant women use illegal drugs. There are all of these other risk factors which we're not focusing on because it keeps the conversation limited. Now, Ethan also asked that we give a personal perspective. I just wanted that redhead over there as me. I'm a nicotine baby. I can't tell by looking at you if you've had an abortion, if you've suffered a stillbirth, if you've had a home birth, if you've refused cesarean surgery, if you've used an illegal drug, if you're addicted, if you've been arrested, if you've served years in jail. We have a lot of coming out to do before we can come together. And whether we think of them as mistakes or sins, we need to forgive ourselves and each other and come together. When I went down to Occupy Wall Street, this is the sign I carried. Something's wrong. People are talking about economic justice. We've got to change the subject. And here's the picture to prove it. I was really there. This is what it's about. If we keep talking about abortion and gay marriage and drugs, then we don't have to talk about the economic inequality, that the racism behind the war on drugs fact that we're willing to spend billions of dollars to imprison people rather than to provide them with health care. I heard Ethan talk about we're not the civil rights movement, and that might make it hard to build our movement. But I have to say that we are a civil rights movement. We are a reproductive rights movement. We are a movement for economic justice. We are a movement for reproductive rights, and we need to come together. For those of you who are working hard with people who are formerly incarcerated or people in the child welfare system trying to get their kids back, you spend a lot of time helping people to learn compliance so they can stay out of jail, so they might have a chance of being with their children again. But we have to figure out, and this is a really big challenge, that while we're helping people comply with systems so they are not punished and have families destroyed, how do we teach them also political defiance? Oh, I have to go back. I missed this. So At Occupy Wall Street, they also had Occupy Legoland. And if you look carefully, you can see Dr. Stanton helping people with overdose kits, and Tony Newman and Jana Zintzi talking about how drug war and reproductive rights are all connected. In any event, to keep that going, we have to talk not just about compliance, but teaching political defiance. Pregnant women, when they're told that they can't have abortions, they do political defiance, and they have them anyway. Pregnant women in other countries are told they can't have more than one child. They engage in political defiance, and they have those children anyway. We are told we can't use drugs. We use them anyway. Prohibition doesn't work except if it is designed to do what it's designed to do, which is to control populations, or which is another way of population control, which is why reproductive rights and drug policy movements need to come together. My challenge is to make sure that we go beyond ending a drug war so that we are also talking about drug policy justice, because we know what happens when we leave from a country and we don't make sure that there's the infrastructure for healthcare and housing and meeting the economic needs of people. My challenge is making sure that the people I talk to understand that we cannot have a culture of life if we don't also value the women who give that life, including women who use drugs. Thank you.
You're listening to 90.9 FM WGXC. We've been talking today about reproductive rights in the criminal justice system. If you want to continue the conversation, there's an exciting event coming up on Sunday, October 26th from 3 to 5 p.m. in Kingston. It's called Building Community to Transform Our Criminal Justice System. This is taking place at the LGBTQ Center in Kingston, New York at 300 Wall Street from 3 to 5 p.m. It's part of the newly formed LGBTQ Task Force to Undo Mass Incarceration and Institutional Racism. The session is going to be a panel discussion on criminal justice issues such as incarcerated women, reentry, LGBTQ prisoners, and Ulster County literacy rates. Speakers at the event will include Victoria Law, who's the author of Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women, Imogene Simmons Kelly, who's a community activist working on reentry in Kingston, Thea Dubow, advocate for women incarcerated for resisting domestic violence, and Stacey Lynn Burnett, a community activist working on ending the abuse of LGBTQ prisoners. Again, this is an event called Building Community to Transform Our Criminal Justice System, taking place on Sunday, October 26th from 3 to 5 p.m. at the LGBTQ Community Center at 300 Wall Street in Kingston, New York. Thanks for listening today to the Prison Voices Project. I'm Alexandra Cox, and I'm a member of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, second floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish